Well, it's a real pleasure to be able to address the fundamental issues of getting transferring knowledge and technology to Africa, and to, I would suggest, the same in South Asia and the other pockets in Latin America where we have extreme poverty. Dr. Deaton said, affecting 860 million people, but we really have about 600 million in locked in extreme poverty, some of them in what's called ultra poverty in Africa. So what are the socioeconomic conditions that really are barriers to doing anything to transform that yield gap and actually get rid of it to a large extent? First of all, we have deep poverty. I'm using Malawi as an example. 9 million out of 17 million have a per capita income of less than a dollar a day. I updated this, and the per capita annual average of what's called GDI, gross domestic income, per person is $250 in Malawi. If you can imagine per year, that's even though there are many people making a lot of money in the cities. However, the lower third of the population really are not able to live within an economic system that we actually have functionally any cash flow. So you really don't have people with the money to have commercial seed and fertilizers and casual labor, insecticides, all these things are really out of the reach unless government comes in and some private NGO comes in and gives them all these resources. And as I talk about the Mzungo in, Mzungo out collapse of programs, which is a systemic problem in these parts of Africa, unless there is a new way of evaluating actually introducing transformative change economically into the village, these same problems are going to persist. We have post-harvest failures in Malawi of 40%. The predatory market conditions are overwhelming. If you can imagine, you work so hard, you get 8, 10 bags, 50 kg bags of maize, and you work so hard, and you don't have any other money because it's been 5 months you've been growing this, and so you need something for some kind of a crisis right when the crop is able to be sold. Instead of holding it and the money doubling, the value of doubling in 4 to 6 months, at the farm gate there are predators, and so the farmers are vulnerable, they're cashless. And people are literally ruthless. And you get institutional farmer organizations, I don't want to name the names, but you have corrupt and predatory managements that actually treat the smallholder in these farmer organizations that are supposed to be for them in the same way. And they take, and they'll ride around in their four-wheel, and they'll have the name of the subsistence farmer organization on it. And the management winds up doing well, and the people really don't. Politically and financially, there are people who are members of parliament and other bigwigs, bureaucrats, who are connected to these to buyers, sometimes through third parties. And they actually go to the smallholders, buy it up, the products, and then sell it later, manipulating. And then you get official manipulations of the grain exchanges. We were the only NGO in Malawi this year that actually used the official grain exchange. It was said, it's absolutely the way to go. Well, the government just said, told the managements, don't sell anything in the grain exchange. We're going to come buy it all up. They offered us a price that was better than what we'd heard before. This is while the government is announcing that there's going to be a 3 million people in hunger, which means starvation, starting in a month or two. 2 weeks after we made the deal and they bought everything that was available from the private sector, they paid twice as much money to the government of Zambia to buy a whole bunch and fill the grain reserve. So what we find here is You have commercial banks also involved with predatory lending. Commercial banks in Malawi, their annual rate is 45 to 55%, and those are the big banks' names, for term loans during the growing season, but only for the creditworthy, which is not really available by the subsistence farmer at the village level. Now, there are organizations that are supposedly do-gooders coming from Britain that are financial institutions owned by entrepreneurs that will lend widows money at because women will pay back their loans at 45 to 100% rates. It's just awful. Here we'd call it criminal, and I think it is. But that's what keeps the entire system locked in poverty and neighborhood. And there actually are neighborhood banks that are actually springing up. I talked to a man who's presenting here. He's a great guy at the University of Agriculture. He said his church choir got into this, where everybody will put money in a pool and start lending it out to their neighbors and to one another, that people that they know, at 45 to 50%. This is the church choir. And if anybody falls behind, they get up to 1,000% interest rate. You know, as the sort of things that we don't like the penalty fees when we're late in a payment ourselves here with our Chase cards or whatever. But this is a system that also doesn't provide, if you do the field work, the caloric inputs. So people, while they're working hard, and it's 70% of the labor, and some by some estimates, only 50% by other estimates, are women in the fields. And women get second divvy to the grain. The men eat first in the culture, and the caloric inadequacy for their needs is not there. The gender workload is unequal, and then when they do get some extra cash, if they do have any cash crop, the man takes it and then distributes what's left after his desires and needs are met. The illiteracy and problem in technology transfer, which has to occur through a structured village framework, requires that often leadership and farmers that are going to be making decisions and agreements are illiterate. And when you have a subsistence mentality, you really don't think about what's going to happen 6 months from now or 2 months ago. 2 months from now, you really think about what's going to happen next week. Are you going to feed yourself, including the chiefs and their extended families? You get a resistance to farming system change where you might come in and introduce it, whether it's the government or an NGO, after 50 years or 30 years of NGOs coming in and saying, do it this way, do it that way. Often the conservation agriculture techniques are contradictory, one NGO to the other. You get real resistance and confusion. Oh, yeah, you know, there they are again. So we'll have our town meeting. We'll see what this one's going to promise. So these are all very important factors, and there functionally is a lack of presence and authority of the university extension at the village level. The idea that America and the British and the EU and Western donors have had for 30 to 50 years is we need to build university capacities like we have in the land-grant universities of the United States, and we need those capacity-building institutions. The problem is, The four things that happen in America so that we are the leader of the world in agricultural yields and therefore profits and cash flow and that whole sector of our economy, those four sectors do not exist. They can have a university which is an island of academic activity, and literally the people are starving at the border of the university. And so what do you do? What are the things that have to change? Well, I'm going to spend the next few minutes just going through the list of factors that I had in my abstract, if I can have a copy of that. just because I gave them all out. I put them on my updated version here. But I just want to say that these are all things that need funding, and I'm going to show that that after my research for 3 to 4 years actually on the ground trying to help in a situation, but constantly analyze what is missing. How are we going to do this? What I've come up with, and our team on our board of directors have come up with, we think will work. And it's got a lot of enthusiasm at universities in particular that we've contacted with this approach. But let's look at these five sociological strategies and economic strategies that have to occur. We do have to continue funding the knowledge strategy. We have to have a water strategy that works, because in the part of Africa I'm in, but generally in sub-Saharan Africa where there isn't a rainforest, you have large periods of the year where there's inadequate or consistent water. We do have to fund optimal inputs to make it possible for high-yield agriculture. And we do have to actually work on post-harvest infrastructure development with efficiencies like we have. Otherwise, it's, you know, grown and lost. Then we have to really work on the nutrition of the daily worker, because it takes 5,000 calories to work out in the sun for 6 hours. And the average person maybe gets 1,800 to 2,200 if they're eating within that farming sector. So the other thing that we need is we need to see these specific transformations, and I'll discuss the model. Solar corridor fits in beautifully because you can functionally double the yields on maize, which is the main staple. You can functionally use the coast solar corridor to double the maize production per lineal foot in an intercropping situation that has all kinds of nutritional benefits and economic benefits. But you actually have to have a social capacity in order to introduce that technology. But it is a transforming one, and I think a lot of research needs to, and implementation has to be done with solar corridor in order to make that work in this ideal environment where you have sun, 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 and if we can provide the water and the nutrients, which can be done through technology, you can really have an economic impact. As we heard from Dr. Deaton this morning, he mentioned that you get a huge GDP bang out of supporting the smallholder community. In fact, I found studies in Zimbabwe done in coordination, I believe, with the World Bank in the 1990s that gave it a times, can you imagine this, times 22. That you build a manufacturing job in the United States, you get a times 3 GDP, you know, impact. You get 22. So, and it tends to really vivify the local economy, and in many ways it has a magic if you actually can bring in resources that are used in farming and outputs. So it's a great investment. But where you need to do this requires that you walk through the front door with your local village government structures. And they have got to agree to be agents with you of fundamental change, accelerated change. And often these structures are bastions of resistance. They can sit down and agree, but in fact, what actually happens after you reach an agreement, it can be another matter. So you do have to deal with chief, privy council, elders, and the common people. In Malawi, they have the whole traditional authority of governance structures boiled down to what they call the village. And so you really have to have a village approach. And then we need to transform the acquisition of knowledge and its application by actually educating the people while they are receiving economic benefits. We actually believe in our foundation that it's not too much to ask. That if a chief and his family is actually getting into a program that's going to feed them, that chief should learn to read. And other people who are directly getting the benefits of a program that's being extended to transform them permanently. You do need a parent who reads in order to have a vivacious interest in the entire public education offering in a country which the government does spend a lot of money on, and money that is not well spent if there isn't a supportive parent. And there, we believe that numeracy skills are required. You actually have to think, as we know, to be a farmer. Now, it was also pointed out this morning that women are enormously initiative creators in the process of farming, and it's certainly true that they are the center of family responsibility. So we need to transform the attitudes and the motivation by actually tying the payouts to any improvements to performance by monetizing what they do in their tasks. And we have to have we have to help them develop a virtue-driven culture of behavior. 80% of the village population, and the country has 80% villages in Malawi, are unemployed about 70% of the time. Okay, 80% of the people are unemployed 70% of the time. And the women tend to work harder. So we have to when we extend opportunities, see something working so that an entire different ethic takes hold. And then we have to transform the motivation for achievement and actually have leadership development where women and children are included, and leaders that think about the women and children first. And women, of course, have been involved with it. Now, I would like to cut to the chase, and I want to have, if Leroy would pass this out, Leroy, I'd like to show you what we've come up with the university, as we heard from Dr. Deaton this morning. Universities really are his focus in creating capacity. I'll keep this one and you can keep the rest. What we've come up with is a model in conjunction with the very technically savvy universities that they have over there in agriculture, about what drip irrigated farming using all the advanced suite of techniques in agronomy and competently managed would mean. Now, we know throughout Africa there are individual examples, and of course Israel is, and the state of California, Nebraska, by the way, is the number one state in irrigation in the United States, interestingly. But we've got, whether Spain or throughout the world, we've got some really large farming operations in drip irrigation. Well, in the African environment, you have sun all the time. The solar factor, which really is a transformative focus that this solar corridor is all about, could be used 365 for all year farming in sub-Saharan Africa. And the actual profit structures, after all costs, with drip irrigated systems that have a 20-year lifespan, 25-year lifespan, are in the range of $13,000 to $15,000 profit per hectare per year. Can you imagine that? Imagine that. When the smallholder, if there's a way to actually increase the smallholder's capacity by creating the economic structures for to smallholders to get drip irrigation in the village, and with a suite of social capacity building, social responsibility approaches, it would be possible for smart foundations creating farmer cooperatives to work with commercial agriculture companies to provide the levels of service with those profit margins, assuming that all the value chain issues are eliminated. So what we've envisioned is a relationship with Malawi's premier agricultural universities. There are actually three of them, three campuses, to put large commercial farms adjacent to the universities, to build these universities' capacities, and using government now policy, which is very oriented to helping smallholder and helping the export markets to India, for instance. India has an unfulfilled demand of pigeon pea right now of 250,000 metric tons a year. Okay, and Malawi is already a significant producer, but with drip irrigation optimized for the best yields they have in India, you can have $12,000 to $15,000 profit per hectare, and that can be done at the village level. So, what we believe is there has to be a new relationship between the major players, including one that doesn't exist functionally in Africa. And that is a corporate model. And we're actually creating a corporation, and we already have the foundation in place that is owned by technically expert Malawians associated with the university in order to drive agriculture commercially. And so with this, I will rest. And I do want to say, however, that the Solar Corridor research for both domestic Western transformation in terms of use of land, water, and sun is, I think, is important. But it's critical to what has to happen across the world in the villages.
Thank you very much.